Well, welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. And today I'm joined with Dave Farber, who's widely known as the grandfather of the internet. And we've done a couple of podcasts with Dave before, which you can get from iTunes and from our website. So, you know, check those out. And thanks for joining us again, Dave.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Yeah, it's we're coming up to the end of the year, and which is kind of an arbitrary construct, but what the heck. It seems like a good time to take stock of what happened in 2016. I think it's probably going to take us a while to figure it all out because it was such an extraordinary year. And then look forward a bit to what may happen in 2017. So I think we can kind of divide this up into two parts. There's obviously the election of Donald Trump was one of the most, I mean, did anything happen in the regular world in 2016 that was more unpredictable or more impactful than that?
Well, certainly the departure of the UK from the EU was unexpected,
mm-hmm.
And has had and will have strong repercussions. The sort of relatively stagnant economy during large parts of the year. The beginning of or continuing of the belief of countries that they had to do something about the internet was also, I thought, a highlight.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was last year, in the U.S. context, the movement of the FCC to make the internet and things on it subject to Title II.
Yeah, that happened the year before last, but the implications of that certainly played out this year,
yeah,
with privacy, yeah, regulations, and tried to take some action on set-top boxes, but that ultimately didn't go anywhere. But well, yeah, mainly it was the privacy regulations this year.
Privacy regulations, certainly, but the whole sort of tone of things started changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think from a technology standpoint, the thing the year brought out was the fact that security is become even more an important problem on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be racing ahead of our ability to do anything about it.
Yeah. So it's correct to say that the security problem basically has two main parts. One of them is data breaches, which were a really big thing in 2016. It probably even impacted the election. We got to look at John Podesta's email. We got to look at Debbie Wasserman Schultz's email, and that may have actually suppressed the turnout a bit. Some of the Bernie supporters are probably even more reluctant to come out and vote for Hillary. But we also had the DDoS attacks.
And the beginning of the attacks on the Internet of Things, the proliferation of Internet of Things devices in the house. I hate that word, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't
really be any more vague, could it?
No, it couldn't. No. And the susceptibility of those devices to attack.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the DDoS attacks. It's the fact that they are subject to other things. I mean, there have been cases where thermostats have been breached and caused trouble.
Mm-hmm.
In houses. Again, it's a sign of something's wrong in the underpinnings, and I think 2016 brought that out to everybody.
Well, you know, we did a BitTag report this year about security and the Internet of Things, because when something like this comes up, Congress and the FCC just want to do something. I mean, politicians all over the world want to be seen to be taking some sort of an action, even if they don't really have any idea what to do.
Right.
And so, you know, we tried to give policymakers some guidance and, you know, reiterated the fact that the internet can't solve the lack of security in IoT devices all by itself. I mean, the major part of this comes down to the manufacturers of the devices to put software in them that's relatively up to date, and to have mechanisms for continuing to, you know, update, keep the software up to date as vulnerabilities are discovered. Because basically the internet is it's an arms race between, you know, the hackers who find vulnerabilities and the good guys who patch them, right?
And under those conditions, usually the people who attack have a have an advantage, because once they attack, it takes a while to fix.
Mm-hmm.
That period, you know, depending on how well they communicate, you're vulnerable. And it's beginning. I think the problem is that it's vulnerabilities are popping up too fast and too often, not just in the Internet of Things, but in our infrastructure. The power systems still are vulnerable. There's just an awful lot of vulnerability because of the infusion of technology. That doesn't mean you stop the technology, found benefits, but it means that we have to pay a lot more attention to what we're doing in order to keep it from getting really out of hand.
Yeah, one of the vulnerabilities that was discovered by, it's been discovered by researchers and written up, I don't think it's been exploited yet, but the potential for it is really kind of frightening. It's a, there's a feature in Zigbee where like there's a secret number that if you know this one secret number, basically everybody that uses Zigbee uses the same password. The password can't be changed, and it's a security by obscurity thing where the number is only supposed to be known by the good guys who manufacture Zigbee devices. Zigbee's a mesh network, so if you can compromise a light bulb, it proliferates through, you know, through, you could basically turn off, you know, if Zigbee were widely deployed, you could turn off all the lights in the city just by knowing this number, which is apparently not that hard, you know, not that well protected.
Yeah, well, even a well protected, we've just, history has shown what even well-protected things. The one that scares the hell out of me, and it will happen someday, most likely, the update mechanisms of both Microsoft and Apple.
Mm-hmm.
They've kept very secure, but they're going to be compromised someday.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a given, right? Anything that can be compromised in the fullness of time will be.
And it could be. There are a number of ways it could happen, and the result could be catastrophic, because you make bricks out of a couple of million machines.
Well, if you're a manufacturer of computers, that's a good thing. Yeah. Both Apple and Microsoft are manufacturers of machines.
I think, yeah. It's
that'd sort of be a public relations disaster, though.
First magnitude.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that I think has... I've sort of been sensitized to is the fact that the international laws that govern the prosecution of cyber crimes are very weak, if existent at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a person at Interpol, and he said that it's very, very difficult to prosecute almost any cyber crime in some countries because their law wasn't set up for it. Not an issue of not willingness to do it. It's just that the whole law system is built up to deal with physical devices. You rob.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Not you.
So we would have to characterize the damage done by a cyber criminal in concrete terms, in like monetary terms or physical loss terms.
Yeah. And a significant number of countries don't have that. Other countries just refuse to deal with it. So we're facing an international environment that we have no effective way of controlling it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was fairly recently, there was something in the news about the takedown of the largest botnet that had ever been taken down. It's a project that I think the FBI and Homeland Security worked on for maybe 2 or 3 years before they were able to put it all together, but it involved a lot of cross-border cooperation, extradition, you know, sharing of intelligence. And I mean, there's so many issues that come to the fore in terms of, well, the privacy regulations that can make it difficult to prosecute these things, international cooperation. I mean, it's a lot of these enterprises are based in countries that may be based in one country and then carried out in another country. And if the two countries aren't on the friendliest of terms, you've got sort of it's a brilliant recipe for, you know, for doing harm and making money.
And the other thing that worries me in the future, this is a future problem, as cyber attacks become more international, I worry that nation states are going to react in unpredictable ways. And that could be a major source of problems for argument's sake, if you know that a certain country or you think that a certain country is providing the infrastructure and support for attacking another country, for argument's sake, mm-hmm. and the attack is to take down a major part of, say, a power system, what's your response? The response is not going to be pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, it's like trolling, right? I mean, if you can get somebody to make an irrational response, then you get other people that respond to the irrational response, and you get a cascade of ever-increasing, ever more irrational responses to the point where the entire system is destabilized.
Yeah, you also get the thinking, I won't say where I heard this, but I think it's interesting to relate it. A question of what do you do if you believe that, I'll use a particular case, that an attack is being made from a country, let's say China, just for just for hypothetical. It could be Russia, it could be France, what do you do? Well, first of all, there's always the problem of really knowing who did it. Even if the perpetrators are within a country, do you have any concrete way of knowing that it's government-sponsored? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I suspect that, in fact, it's very hard to do that.
Well, and I think if the attacker is an individual or a member of, like, a criminal syndicate, first thing he wants to do is to make it look like he's a state actor.
So there was a document published at a meeting I was at, which said, well, there are three things you can do. One is you can remove that country from the domain name system, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's not going to do anything.
That's not going to do anything. Second thing is disconnect that country from the internet. I'm not sure how you do that.
Yeah, it's a lot easier said than done, that's for sure.
And the third thing was to respond with kinetic response.
Oh, that sounds like somebody I used to work with who was talking about that. But and so I think that's exactly what they want, right? If someone attacks you, they expect you to attack them back, then your counterattack basically is part of their strategy.
Right, and the headache is many years ago in the 40s and 50s, we had a similar problem with nuclear attacks. Mm-hmm. And, people like Herman Kahn looked at all of them and realized that in some sense, a nuclear attack was counterproductive because the response would be this, or this, mm-hmm. that escalation. I'm not at all sure that a really serious cyber attack wouldn't get us into a position where it could escalate quite rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could. If counterattack is part of the strategy, which it's not today. I mean, today we consider what we want to do is neutralize the attack by essentially shutting off the data flows, one by one until, it ceases to make any difference. But if we think we can do that, if instead of doing that, we go into a counterattack mode, then it's like an amplification attack, right?
Yeah.
And so, a DNS amplification attack, I send a query to DNS that asks for a rather large amount of information. And the actual substance of the attack isn't what I send to DNS, it's what DNS sends back. And it will send it back to whatever address I tell DNS to send it to. So that's, and amplification attacks are in DNS, SNMP, like lots of features of the internet's kind of quasi-infrastructure, the software that everybody uses that's on top of the routers is subject to that sort of manipulation until it's specifically, controls are specifically engineered to make that not possible.
Yeah, the mechanisms are there to cause problems. And if you listen to at least the verbiage that comes out of some countries, including the US, mm-hmm. we want to be able to attack in response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a troubling part of the cybersecurity dialogue. And it's something that I have to say, I've been, up close to people who were proposing that as a strategy and seen people who were in senior positions in the U.S. security apparatus kind of nod their heads approvingly. But these are not computer people. These are not, these, you know, these are political people and military people and, you know, administrators, and don't think they're working through all the implications.
That's correct. As they didn't for a long time in the nuclear game.
Mm-hmm. It's like a game of 3D chess where the chess pieces have machine guns.
That's correct. Very complicated world. The other thing that I think happened towards the end of last year, and I think has another set of future real serious problems, is the quote, false news.
Oh, fake news, yeah.
Yeah, fake news. That just raises a whole set of issues that are interesting, I think is a nice way of putting it.
Well, now, the free speech issues?
The free speech issues, you know, the notion that some, to me, the notion that somebody can sit and arbitrate who, which piece of information, which person is saying the true things as opposed to the false things, mm-hmm. gets you an awful lot of problems, because that's a form of censorship.
Yeah.
And censorship can be in both ways. You know, you take a case which, just for amusement, take a person who makes a statement about about evolution. I could see some censor saying, that's clearly false news, because evolution doesn't exist.
So right, the Bible says so.
Yeah, drop that out. And that, I think, is going to be a serious, serious problem both ways. We have to do something. What we have to do is just not at all clear. We have to educate people. Mm-hmm. Now, some people, as I think it was PBS thing, an NPR thing today, I was listening to as I was driving, maybe it was yesterday, where they pointed out that some people enjoy the game of creating false news and amplifying it.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is just a serious problem, because people will react with censorship. They'll react with demands that people who make statements, that we know who they are.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, no more anonymity.
No more anonymity. I think there's, if you listen to Trump, you know, he doesn't like, he would love to have some way of getting at people who say things to him that he thinks is libelous.
Well, it's a curious phenomenon too, because fake news was a big part of his, or at least the sort of, it's larger than fake news. It's like the rumor mill. There's kind of a rumor mill operating in politics. I mean, he over and over and over repeated things that he attributed to what other people are writing and saying. They were just blatantly ridiculous, like the idea that 3 million illegal voters voted for Hillary, and without that, he would have won the popular vote. I mean, there's not a shred of truth in that.
But it does, for a politician, it's handy not to necessarily tell the truth. The trouble is that it impacts other people, like the Pizzagate or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
That type of thing actually had impacts on people. I'm afraid, or maybe I'm not afraid, but I believe that we'll probably see a weakening of the First Amendment. Not really the First Amendment. There's no, as everybody knows, First Amendment deals with the federal government's ability to legislate against certain forms of speech. Nothing says that companies can't.
That's true. And companies respond to pressure. Respond to regulatory pressure. They respond to contracts. The kind of look at the inducements that Carrier got for keeping some workers in Indiana and sending some to Mexico. You apply those kind of inducements to a company that to Facebook, and obviously Facebook is probably less vulnerable to that kind of manipulation than Carrier is, because they don't live on government contracts like United Technologies does. I mean, but you can produce it. These are the chilling effects that, you know, EFF is always talking about. And the entire free speech advocacy is really very concerned about chilling effects on speech, right?
Yep, that's correct. The just going back, a lot of people don't realize that the First Amendment is a very constrained thing. The other, our broadcast, our TV people are always subject to a very informal, but could be made considerably harsher. They have to renew their license. In the old days, you had to actually justify renewing license.
And part of that was the equal time.
Equal time, the response, the opinions of the customers as to whether you were providing fair, equitable, etc. Now basically you send a postcard, but that there are handles, and that can be justified without saying I want to constrain what you're saying.
Well, but a lot of TV broadcasters are giving up their spectrum licenses in the incentive auction, so that lever is not going to be as powerful across the board as it has been.
The problem is that TV is becoming less powerful. Newspapers are still powerful in some ways, but certainly not the impact they used to have. And it's this this easy ability of, and it's going to be worse in the future, easy ability of communities to separate and insulate themselves. Years we had good news radio stations, which only broadcast good news.
So it's like Disneyland, huh?
Equivalent. Yeah. We had religious stations, which only broadcast things that were proper for their religion. And people, a surprising number of people would just listen to those. So they got all the news from people that thought the same way they thought. On the internet, that's even easier now. You don't need why. You just, I'm sure there are a lot of people, and you know, I find myself somewhat in that boat where there are some news sources that I trust, right? But I have no assurance that I really should trust them all the time. So I go out of the way to to look at things that I know have a completely opposite perspective.
Well, that's kind of what we have to do. I read there was something in the press today about where some of the fact checkers like PolitiFact and FactCheck.com and Snopes were proposing to Facebook that a way that Facebook could deal with the fake news problem is that when they identify a story that they think is fake news, they don't have to suppress it. But you know how on Facebook you read something and at the bottom there'll be like maybe three or four similar stories that they suggest. And so the Facebook fake news problem is that fake news shows up in that list, and so people are directed towards it by Facebook. But what happens if every time one of these suspect stories shows up in a feed like that, there's also a fact checker, like right after it, there's a fact checker. So it's like, you know, the traditional, the solution to the problem of the abuse of free speech is actually more speech.
Right. But I would prefer that there not be a censorship organization that does that. Now that's subject to poor use also, to bad use also.
Well, and one of the things I've found is that in arguing with people who hold political views that are different from my own, when they provide me with one of these fake facts, what I think is a fake fact, I say, well, you know, Snopes says that's a myth. Yeah. And their reaction is, well, Snopes is rigged. You know, so if you're in the bubble, you're in the bubble.
Yeah. And it's hard to break out.
Okay. This is a good time to take a break. We have more to discuss, and we'll do that in a second part of this interview with Dave Farber, the grandfather of the internet, on the technology developments that caught our attention in 2016 and what we're looking forward to in 2017. The High Tech Forum podcast is a production of the hightechforum.org website, available on the website as well as on iTunes. And of course, we appreciate your reviews on iTunes. So this is Richard Bennett signing off.